This evening, we're continuing this sermon series that I've titled America's Patriot Pastors. Now, by way of review, it'll help us to first remember that the Patriot Pastors I'm specifically referring to, well, these were the clergymen whose sermons paved the way for the Revolutionary War. And not only that, but I'm also referring to the Patriot Pastors who stepped down from their pulpits and out onto the battlefield. And it's for this reason that they became known by the Brits as the Black-Robed Regiment. It was during the first study of this series, that's when we considered several sermons that helped the Christians there in the colonies to realize that the Lord wasn't requiring them to live in subjection to the tyranny of ungodly rulers who were themselves refusing the law of nature and the laws of society as well as the law of God. And in this way, we saw how the Revolutionary War was actually inspired by those patriot pastors who were actually using their pulpits to present a biblical position on politics. Then in our study last week, well, we took the time to consider some of the 18th century sermons that clearly inspired the document, which is better known as the Declaration of Independence. What we discovered was that the unalienable rights that we find described in the Declaration of Independence, well, they had been the subject of several sermons and for many, many years. With that being the case, you know, we can say with great certainty then that America's patriot pastors were, these politically minded men whose sermons inspired the Declaration of Independence, which explicitly identifies our unalienable rights that have been granted to us by our Creator. Now, here in our study tonight, well, we're going to spend our time considering how the U.S. Constitution, which I'll remind you was written in 1787, this was also inspired by the patriot pastors who were preaching from America's pulpits during the 18th century. To put it in the words of a 20th century historian named Alice Baldwin, the Constitutional Convention and the written Constitution were the children of the pulpit. Just consider that for a second. The Constitutional Convention and the written Constitution were the children of the pulpit. Our U.S. Constitution was inspired by the sermons that America's patriot pastors were preaching from their pulpits. And with this as the focus, I want to spend the rest of our time tonight just considering how America's patriot pastors actually provided the leaders of our nation with a biblical basis for the fundamental principles that our government is founded upon. And I'd like to begin by first considering the preamble of the U.S. Constitution, which reads in this way: "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." As we take a closer look at this introduction, we must not fail to notice the important topics that are found in this sentence. We find topics that include judicial justice, domestic tranquility, national security, general welfare, and individual liberty. From this, we can see that our Constitution, which lists the body of fundamental principles of our federal union, this document identifies these five main categories that our government is expected to institute and protect. Now, with this as the focus, I just want to take some time to consider the sermons that inspired these five categories, beginning with judicial justice. I'll give you one example. It's found in 1730. That's when Pastor Benjamin Coleman presented a sermon which he titled, "Government, the Pillar of the Earth." Now, during this sermon, Pastor Coleman appealed to Psalm 36 as he declares, "God's righteousness and faithfulness, justice and judgment are the foundation of his everlasting government, the habitation of his throne. See the pillars of the divine government. Thy faithfulness reacheth to the clouds. Thy righteousness is as the great mountains. Nor can the kingdoms and provinces on the earth stand, but on the like basis of a just and righteous, humane government." In other words, the government that seeks to establish judicial justice, well, they must first look to the God who has actually established the pillars of divine government. You see, when it comes to the concept of justice, you know, we have to ask, well, what kind of justice are we talking about? Who creates the standard? Are we talking about equitable justice? Are we talking about social justice? What kind of justice are we talking about? Well, we have to look to the God of justice to even begin to pin down what we mean when we even use the word justice. And so in order to have a nation that's established on judicial justice, we need to look to the God who created justice. And not only that, but we also need leaders who are themselves just. This was precisely the point that Pastor Charles Chauncey was making back in 1747. He presented an election sermon, which he titled, "Civil Magistrates Must Be Just, Ruling in the Fear of God." And here's what he said. Those who rule over others must be just, ruling in the fear of God. Here I shall distinctly say they must be just. They ought to be so in their private capacity, maintaining a care to exhibit in their conduct towards all they are concerned with, a fair transcript of that fundamental law of the religion of Jesus, as well as eternal rule of natural justice. All things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. Now from this, we see that this patriot pastor, he was actually presenting this election sermon during which he called every earthly ruler to embrace the fundamental law of Jesus Christ, as well as the eternal rule of natural justice, so that these rulers might rule over others in a way that is truly just. Pastor Chauncey also declared this, "'Tis not enough, I say, that rulers don't, in these and such like ways, pervert judgment and justice, but besides all this, they must be positively righteous, being possessed of an inward, steady, uniform principle of justice, setting them in a good measure above the influence of private interest or party views. They must do that which is equal and right in their various stations, from the king in supreme to the lowest in authority under him. Simply put, everyone occupying a position in the government must make sure that they're following the principles of true justice as defined by God, because God is the one who has actually established the standard of what is just." We should also consider a statement that Pastor Samuel Sherwood presented in 1774. It was during a sermon which he titled "Scriptural Instructions to Civil Rulers and All Freeborn Subjects." It was during this sermon when Pastor Sherwood declared, "Subjects have rights, privileges, and properties, and are countenanced and supported by the law of nature, the laws of society, and the law of God, in demanding full protection in the enjoyment of these and the impartial distribution of justice from their rulers." In other words, the law of nature, the laws of society, and the law of God, all of these realms of law require rulers to maintain the impartial distribution of justice for those living under their authority. And it's for this reason that the creators of our nation's constitution, they listed the establishment of judicial justice as this first fundamental principle of our federal government. It was at the top of the list. They recognized that this nation must be, you know, built upon justice first and foremost, and not some sort of social justice which bends and folds to the whims of whatever group is in charge. But true justice, biblical justice, godly justice. I like the way that President James Madison put it when he declared this. He says, "Justice is the end of government," or the main goal of government, he says. "It is the end of civil society. It ever has been and ever will be pursued until it be obtained, or until liberty be lost in the pursuit." from this quote from one of our presidents, we can see that the more perfect union of our federal government was initially formed in order to establish justice, to pursue it and achieve it, even in the face of tyranny like King George from Great Britain. Not only that, but the Constitutional Convention also convened in order to ensure domestic tranquility by labeling this within our Constitution. Let's take another look here at this preamble of the U.S. Constitution, which reads, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, and secondly, to ensure domestic tranquility." Now, just to be clear about, you know, domestic tranquility, I just want to put this simply. This speaks of a nation that enjoys the tranquil peace that occurs whenever evildoers are punished and law-abiding citizens are protected. We can't have domestic tranquility if evildoers are promoted and law-abiding citizens are punished. No, domestic tranquility happens when evildoers are punished and law-abiding citizens are protected. And as we consider this fundamental principle of our nation's government, we must not fail to realize that this was, you know, first taught from the pulpits of America's patriot pastors. For example, if we look back to Pastor Benjamin Coleman's sermon, which again was titled Government, the Pillar of the Earth, we find this patriot pastor, he's presenting his parishioners with the biblical principle by declaring this. He says, "The mountains shall bring peace to the people, and the little hills by righteousness. Both the superior and inferior magistrates shall minister abundantly to the stability and tranquility of the state." In other words, every level of leadership from the mountains, which are being compared to the superior magistrates, and the hills, which are being compared to the inferior magistrates, both levels of civil leadership are expected to secure domestic tranquility as they use their authority, whatever level it is, to seek to establish peace for the people that they've actually been called to lead. So every government official should recognize that it's their job to attempt to secure peace for the people they oversee. Pastor Coleman elaborates on this by declaring this: "The peace, tranquility, and flourishing of places are made to depend on the wisdom and fidelity of their rulers in the good administration of the government. While the utmost misery and confusion befalls those places where the government is ill-administered. The reason is given in the text. God has set the world on this foot. It can't stand on any other bottom. The virtue and religion of a people, their riches and trade, their power, honor, and reputation, and the favor of God toward them, with his blessing on them, do greatly depend on the pious, righteous, and faithful government which they are under." Wow, simply put, the only nations that will actually experience the true peace of domestic tranquility are those nations where the government is established upon the truth of God's word. The government must be established upon the truth of God's word, and from that foundation, from that footing, then they can begin to establish domestic tranquility for the people they lead. I like the way that a pastor from Portsmouth put it back in 1784. I'm referring to Pastor Samuel McClintock. He preached a sermon which was titled "A Sermon on Occasion of the Commencement of the New Hampshire Constitution." In other words, this message was actually given at the time when the New Hampshire Constitution was being codified, which was around 3 years before our national constitution was created. So 3 years prior to the U.S. Constitution, this pastor is presenting this message at the commencement of the New Hampshire Constitution. And it was during this sermon when Pastor McClintock, he encouraged civil leaders to secure domestic tranquility by declaring this. He says, "Rulers, by the very design of their institution, are ministers of God for good to the people. And their situation gives them a peculiar advantage to promote this benevolent design. They are placed on high like a city set upon a hill. The people look up to them as their fathers, guides, and guardians. and confide in their wisdom to devise the best means to alleviate their burdens, to promote their interest and perpetuate their happiness. And when their authority is exercised with justice and moderation, their example has a leading influence in forming the public taste and manners. They are the head of the political body, which moves, animates, and guides the members in their motions. From all these considerations, people have a right to expect that their rulers, to whom they have delegated their authority for the express purpose, will do all in their power to promote their interests and happiness. That's right. Political leaders have been appointed by God for the express purpose of securing domestic tranquility for the people that they're leading. And that's a responsibility that they need to honor God by achieving. Then as Pastor McClintock here began to wrap up this message, he goes on to say this. He says, before I conclude, I will take the liberty briefly to mention some things which it is a more especial manner the duty of rulers to promote as the surest means of establishing their own authority on a firm basis, lengthening the public tranquility and realizing those future scenes of felicity and grandeur, the prospect of which lies before us. As we consider this statement, which was presented 3 years before our U.S. Constitution was created, I have no doubt that this sermon had a great level of influence on the Constitution that we use today for the entire United States. And while it's true that our domestic tranquility can only be secured by just and godly rulers, it's also true that our domestic tranquility is also based on secure borders and a strong military. In order to prove my point, let's take another look at the preamble of the U.S. Constitution, which again reads, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, and third on the list, to provide for the common defense." Now, just to be clear, this reference to this common defense, it has everything to do with the federal government's responsibility to protect our nation from every enemy, both foreign and domestic. This, of course, includes funding a well-armed military, as well as the protection of our nation's border, whether it be, you know, at the ports or at the, you know, natural boundaries or even at the airports, right? And so it's the federal government's job to defend American citizens here in our nation. I like the way that Pastor Charles Chauncey actually addressed this issue back in 1747. This was during the election sermon, which again he titled, "Civil Magistrates Must Be Just, Ruling in the Fear of God." And here's what he said. "Rulers also should endeavor to keep the state from being embroiled in foreign war by contriving in all prudent ways to engage and continue the friendship of neighboring nations by bearing with lesser injuries from them and not hastily resenting greater ones so far as may be consistent with the public safety by sacredly adhering to the treaties and contracts they may have entered into with them by expressing a due caution not to invade their rights or properties." So, you know, basically saying, hey, leave Canada and Mexico alone and we should be fine. Our government shouldn't be engaging in kingdom building either. We don't need to be going, you know, into the world looking for places to go start wars. We shouldn't be looking for every reason why we need to send our soldiers off somewhere to fight some other battle unless there's just cause for it. At the same time, Pastor Chauncey went on to insist that our leaders ought to stand ready to protect our rights and properties against any invading army. And here's how he put it in the same exact sermon. He says, "If, after all, war should arise by means of the pride or avarice or self-will and tyranny of unreasonable men, their concern should now be to look to the preservation of the state at home by providing a sufficiency of warlike stores in their various kinds by guarding the exposed frontiers and coasts, and in a word, by putting and keeping things in such a posture of defense that neither their people nor their interests may easily fall a prey in the enemy's hands." Simply put, our government's job is to provide for the common defense of the citizens who are providing their taxes for this service, and that's what this pastor was saying about our federal government. Let's consider the way that Pastor Moses Mather put it back in 1775. This is in a sermon that he titled America's Appeal to the Impartial World. During this sermon, Pastor Mather declares this. Hence, it is evident that man hath the clearest right by the most indefensible title to personal security, liberty, and private property, and whatever is a man's own, he hath most clearly a right to enjoy and defend, to repel force by force, to recover what is injuriously pillaged or plundered from him, and to make reasonable reprisals for the unjust vexation. And upon this principle, an offensive war may sometimes be justified, namely when it is necessary for preservation and defense. In other words, there are times when a nation must initiate a military campaign against an enemy that's preparing to invade us. Therefore, according to this patriot pastor, you know, the government must be prepared to provide for the common defense of those that they've sworn to protect. And not only that, but it's also the role of our rulers to promote the general welfare of every American. With that, let's take another look at the preamble of the U.S. Constitution, which reads this: "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare." Now, it should be noted that this concept of general welfare, we find this elaborated in the first clause of Article 1, Section 8, here in this U.S. Constitution, and this elaboration reads in this way: "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States." And so, simply put, you know, the federal government has the right to collect taxes in order to pay for the things that the federal government needs in order to effectively run. It's also important to note that this clause, which is called the General Welfare Clause, it doesn't grant Congress the power to legislate for the general welfare of the country. And instead, this simply allows Congress to spend federal money for the general welfare. They don't get to just say, well, this is what general welfare is, and so therefore we have to raise your taxes. They don't get to do that. Now, this could potentially get me up on a soapbox right now, especially as we consider all the abuses of this clause that we've seen over the last 2 years. But anyway, let's just bring it back to the perspective of America's patriot pastors. I want to direct your attention back to a point that Pastor Charles Chauncey made during that election sermon, which was titled, "Civil Magistrates Must Be Just, Ruling in the Fear of God." During this sermon, Pastor Chauncey declares this. He says, "It is for the general good of mankind to keep confusion and disorder out of the world, to guard men's lives, to secure their rights, to defend their properties and liberties, to make their way to justice easy and yet effectual, for their protection when innocent and their relief when injuriously treated, and, in a word, to maintain and good order, and in general, to promote the public welfare in all instances so far as they are able." That's right. It's the government's responsibility to promote the public welfare, which most certainly includes protecting our unalienable rights, especially against government overreach. In the same message, Pastor Chauncey goes on to declare this. He says, "Rulers should be just to promote the general welfare and prosperity of a people by discouraging, on the one hand, idleness, prodigality, profaneness, uncleanness, drunkenness, and the like immoralities, which tend in the natural course of things to their impoverishment and ruin, and by engaging, on the other hand, industry, frugality, temperance, chastity, and the like moral virtues, the general practice whereof are naturally connected with the flourishing of a people in everything that tends to make them great and happy." Now, as we consider what this pastor is saying here, and as we consider what he meant when he described the general welfare and prosperity of the American people, well, it seems clear to me that the government seems to have turned this concept on its head. So we see mention of the promotion of general welfare of the public in the Constitution. Here we find a sermon that was presented prior to the creation of the Constitution, actually identifying what it means to promote the general welfare, and yet it seems like our government is actually promoting all the contrary things. And failing to promote industry, frugality, temperance, chastity, and the like moral virtues. Sadly, it seems like we've kind of lost our way on this one, huh? This brings us to the fifth category, because here we find in the preamble of the U.S. Constitution, it reads, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity." Now, I want to stop there. I want to take a moment to grasp these blessings of liberty. The government's role is to do all of these first four things with the goal of securing the blessings of liberty for us and our posterity, or our offspring, or our children. And in order to grasp these blessings of liberty, it's important for us to understand that liberty, it's not the freedom to do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. That's what we want it to be, but that's not what liberty is. That's what we call licentiousness. And according to the scriptures, licentiousness is sin. We're not talking about the blessings of licentiousness, because there are none. We're talking about the blessings of liberty, which refers to the freedom that the Lord provides to those who will submit their lives to His supreme authority. In order to explain my point, let's consider the content of a sermon that Pastor Isaac Backus presented back in 1773. It's in his message titled, "An Appeal to the Public for Religious Liberty." This is where Pastor Isaac Backus declares this: "The true liberty of man is..." Now get this. "The true liberty of man is to know, obey, and enjoy his Creator, and to do all the good unto, and enjoy all the happiness with and in his fellow creatures that he is capable of, in order to which the law of love was written in his heart, which carries in its nature union and benevolence to being in general, and to each being in particular, according to its nature and excellency, and to its relation and connection to and with the Supreme Being and ourselves." In other words, the highest and holiest form of liberty, it's experienced by those who maintain a close connection with our Creator by faith in Jesus Christ. Therefore, it would be wrong to equate this liberty with licentiousness. It would be wrong to think that, you know, American freedom, well, it's all about just me just getting to do whatever I want to do whenever I want to do it. No, true liberty is to know, obey, and enjoy our Creator. It's important to note that Pastor Backus actually conferred with the delegates of the First Continental Congress back in 1774, where he encouraged them to uphold the religious liberty of every American, regardless of the denomination that they embraced. And so for him, liberty, was even more importantly experienced as Christians were able to just go and attend whatever church they wanted to attend, regardless of the denomination. I actually like the way that Pastor Elisha Williams presented this same principle back in 1744. It's in a sermon which was titled "The Essential Rights and Liberties of Protestants." And this is where Pastor Williams declared this: that the civil authority ought to protect all their subjects in the enjoyment of this right of private judgment in matters of religion, and the liberty of worshiping God according to their consciences. That being the end of civil government, as we have seen, namely the greater security of enjoyment of which belongs to everyone, and this right of private judgment and worshiping God according to their consciences being the natural and unalienable right of every man, what men by entering into civil society neither did nor could give up into the hands of the community, it is but a just consequence that they are to be protected in the enjoyment of this right as well as any other." In other words, listen, the blessings of liberty that our government is supposed to secure for the people of America, the blessings of liberty mentioned by the framers of our U.S. Constitution, this is all about our freedom not to do whatever we want to do whenever we want to do it, but rather the freedom to worship the Lord at the denomination of our choosing. The proof of this can be found in the First Amendment, which we're going to consider in the final study of this series. This includes our right to gather and assemble together and worship the Lord at the church of our choosing. For now, I want to bring it back to our text tonight and to the focus that we have here. We should consider a warning that Pastor Williams presented in the same sermon where he declares this. He says, "It has commonly been the case that Christian liberty, as well as civil, has been lost by little and little. And experience has taught that it is not easy to recover it when once lost. So precious a jewel is always to be watched with a careful eye, for no people are likely to enjoy liberty long that are not zealous to preserve it." Think about that for a moment. Liberty, Christian liberty, civil liberty, should be treated like a precious jewel which you take care of and you preserve and protect, because the minute you lose it, it's difficult to find it again. And if we're not zealously preserving our Christian and our civil liberties, you better believe someone's going to take it away. Listen, the rulers who are ready to rob us of our Christian liberty, that's the same government that has no problem removing our civil liberties right after. Just go study history. Go study any communist regime that has ever risen up. The minute they start removing religious liberties, it's not long before they start removing civil liberties too, because they go hand in hand. With that being the case, it's the patriot pastor who should be quick to sound the alarm. You know, when people come to me and tell me, "Well, you shouldn't be so political. You shouldn't talk so much about politics." Listen, I'll stop talking about politics when the government stops messing with the church. I'm good with separation of church and state. As soon as the government gets out of the church, I'll quit talking about the state. How about that? But as long as the government wants to continue to press down laws and cram down laws and all these sorts of things, I'm going to talk about it. And I'm going to address it. And I'm going to be that patriot pastor who says, "No, you don't get to make these rules. You don't get to remove these liberties. You don't have that right. Unalienable rights are not granted by government. They are given by God. And we better protect it. Because if we don't, there will be tyrants that try to take it away." The very second we see our government starting to infringe upon our unalienable rights, the minute we see them attempting to pass laws against churches and stifle worship and these sorts of things, we have to rise up and take a stand against that. We have to speak out against it. Otherwise, we'll just watch it disappear. And once it's lost, it is not easily found again. With all this in mind, there should be no doubt that the Constitution of our country was heavily influenced by the patriot pastors who preached political messages about judicial justice, domestic tranquility, national security, general welfare, and individual liberty. Before all those topics ended up in our Constitution, they were being preached from the pulpits right there in the colonies. Those patriot pastors also influenced the formation of our government into the three separate branches, which are described as all throughout the first three articles of this foundational document of the Constitution. If you read through past the preamble and you begin to examine the first three articles, you'll find in Article 1, we find the legislative branch, better known as Congress, which consists of the Senate as well as the House of Representatives. Then in Article 2, we find the executive branch, which is occupied by the President of the United States and the Vice President. Then in Article 3, we find the basis for the judicial branch of the United States, which includes one Supreme Court and then the inferior courts, as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish, as it's described. Now, there are those who would insist that these three branches of government were based on the basic government of Great Britain, which includes that executive branch of the king and then also the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And I'm guessing that there may have been some level of influence from those who had come from Great Britain as they began to define the government here in America, that maybe they were looking at the king and the House of Commons and the House of Lords as they created these three branches of government. And yet it seems to me that the legislative, the executive, and the judicial branches of our government, they're actually more reflective of the God that we find in the scriptures here in his holy word. I'll give you the example, which is found in Isaiah chapter 33. It's verse 22, where the prophet Isaiah declares, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, and the Lord is our king. He will save us." And here in this verse, we find Isaiah, he's describing God as judge, as legislator, and as executive or king. And we must not fail to recognize the parallel between this description of God found here in Isaiah 33. These three offices of God are clearly seen in the three branches of government that are described in our U.S. Constitution. It's also interesting to note that this is the same verse that Pastor Jacob Cushing appealed to back in 1778. This was found in his message, which was titled Divine Judgment Upon Tyrants. I love that. I should preach more sermons like with these titles, right? I love these titles. But in this message, Divine Judgment Upon Tyrants, this was delivered 9 years before our national constitution was created. And in this message, Pastor Cushing declares this. He says, "We have encouragement then to hope in God that he will build up Zion, that he will appear still for us under all our distresses and oppression, that he will avenge the innocent blood of our brethren inhumanly shed in the beginning of the present unjust war, that he will render vengeance to his and our adversaries and one day restore tranquility to our country, that he will make our land a quiet habitation when we may view it in perfect peace and free from all fears of hostile invasions. For to us, the words of the prophet Isaiah, the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king. He will save us." Hence, we are naturally led in the last place to observe from the concluding words of my text. Now here in this sermon, we find Pastor Cushing, he's crying out to God, and he's calling upon the one who he says is the judge and the lawgiver and the king. And as he prayed to the Lord, he prayed that God would render vengeance and restore tranquility. I can't help but to wonder if this sermon, presented 9 years before our Constitution was written, if this sermon actually influenced our founding fathers to set up these separate powers of government with these three branches that are based on these three offices of God's rule. I can't say for certain, but it seems to me that, the founding fathers of our government may have had the triune nature of the Godhead in mind as they took time to define these three branches of our single government. We have one government with three separate powers, namely the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Here's how Reverend Perry M. Gother put it as he looked back and considered the foundations of our nation in an article that he titled Government's Trinity, A Separation of Powers. He writes this. He says, "These governmental aspects of God are a result of a holy internal synergy within his character. Similarly, the three persons of the Trinity are in perfect relationship and are in a holy unity with each other. This is the triunitarian Godhead. Did you know that our founders separated government into three different branches, in part in reflection of God's threefold governmental nature?" Very interesting perspective. I believe that further evidence, though, of this can be found in the Paris Peace Treaty of 1783. I don't really have time to get into the whole history of this treaty, but this treaty was actually signed, just a few years, before the Constitution was created. And this is how this Paris Peace Treaty begins. It says, "In the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity." That's the first statement in this peace treaty. Incredible. in the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. That's right. The peace treaty with Paris, which was signed by, get this, John Adams, who was the second president occupying the executive branch of America. It was also signed by Benjamin Franklin, who was in the legislative branch of the Continental Congress, and by John Jay, who was the first Chief Justice of our judicial branch, being chief over the Supreme Court. This document, which begins with the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity, was signed by someone from the executive branch, someone from the Congress, the legislative branch, and someone from the judicial branch. I love it. From this, it seems to me that the founding fathers of our nation had the Trinity on the brain as they began to define the three branches of our government there in the first three articles of our Constitution. Now, as we begin to wrap up this message, there should be no doubt in our minds that our U.S. Constitution was framed by men who were clearly influenced by America's patriot pastors. And as we consider all the evidence that we've examined tonight, you know, it's no wonder that this famous historian named Alice Baldwin, she sums all of this up by declaring this: the Constitutional Convention and the written Constitution were the children of the pulpit. If you're grateful for the U.S. Constitution, and we should be, well, how much more grateful should we be for those patriot pastors who preached those sermons that influenced the content of our Constitution? Without debate, we can see that the Lord used those pastors to lay the foundations for a more perfect form of government. Finally, I want to take a moment to notice that the Constitution doesn't guarantee a perfect government. And you know, there are those who, you know, will insist America was never great, you know, and you know, look at all the failures of our government, and no doubt every government in all of world history has failed. And so if you're coming from this idea, you know, that, well, there's this, you know, utopia. There's a utopia that could exist, and it doesn't. And so this is the worst place in the world. Okay, go find a better place. It's got to be out there, right? If you're coming from the perspective of this place isn't perfect, therefore there must be some utopia, therefore I'm going to rail against what's come before me, be careful with that, because none of us are perfect. And the framers of the Constitution didn't say that they were forming a perfect union, but a more perfect union. More perfect than what? Well, the union that came from. And that's exactly what happened. They formed a more perfect union. And knowing that human leaders always bring their imperfections to the political party, well, we can rejoice in knowing that our founding fathers also gave us a document which can be amended as needed. Now, in our final study of America's patriot pastors, we're going to consider the Bill of Rights, and we're going to consider the rest of the amendments that have helped our nation to protect the unalienable rights of every person. We're going to consider how, you know, the Bill of Rights and the amendments that followed have provided us, you know, with a way of adjusting, you know, as we move forward and correcting things that were wrong along the way. For now, though, I just want to conclude this study by encouraging every Christian to remember that this Constitution, well, it's dependent on whom? We the people. We the people. And this is something that it seems like more and more Americans are failing to grasp here. Because the longer I've lived, the more I've just seen people, you know, looking to the government to fix the problems rather than the people to fix the government. Our government is based on we the people, the will of we the people of the United States, who have been called to help form a more perfect union. And with that being the case, it's crucial for every Christian to realize that, listen, the only way that we can maintain a government that actually glorifies God is by making sure that we here in the church are first submitting to the King of Kings. We need to submit our lives to the triune God. And as we do, we need to be praying for those who are leading this nation. I know how easy it is to complain about government leaders. I'm probably a professional by now, but it's so easy to complain about our leaders. What if we took half of those complaints and just turned them into prayers? I mean, wouldn't that do much more for our nation? If every complaint we offered up about our government were just turned into a prayer for them, how much better would our nation be? Let's pray for our leaders, and let's all also pray for Christian leaders. Let's pray that God would raise up Christian leaders who will lead us according to the truth of God's holy word as we, the people, set out to influence this nation according to God's will so that our nation might be great because God made it that way. Let's pray.